You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Parish Council. As you well know, this is the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. As ever, I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's waiting for you to justify his love. It's Terence Duckholm.
I was alone. I took a ride. I didn't know what I would find there. Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Well, isn't it just? Yes, it absolutely is. Do you have a tree? Do you have tinsel? Do you have paper chains up around the Duckholm Mansion?
The first bit, but not the paper chains. A nice proper tree with very tastefully decorated in one colour only. This year, the theme being gold.
as opposed to last year, what was the theme last year then?
Silver.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, so yeah. you've actually... okay, now you've kind of run out of precious metals now, haven't you?
what have I got left? You know, I suppose I could do sort of ruby, diamond, sapphire,
I
could go through...
Yeah, well, they're stones, aren't they?
They're stones. I could go through stones after...
Oh, you change your decks every year, do you?
Pretty much.
That's very extravagant.
Same lights. Red. The lights are all one colour. They're red. Yeah. So what will go with the red lights? Yeah. And silver or gold quite go quite well. Gold's good.
Yeah, very good. And you say an actual tree, one that was
a real tree
that was once growing. Yes,
one that's growing from the garden centre. Yeah. In a kind of stand thing and. It's always the fear that it's going to shed all its little pine bits before Christmas is even here.
Well, you want to get a spruce, you see, a spruce top. Doesn't drop, you see.
Yeah, no, the one that's on order is one of these non-droppers. But you still, in March, you're still hoovering up the odd
No, you get yourself a spruce top, you know, the ones that, with the long needles, you know, the long swept up needles. They don't drop a thing, not a thing.
Okay. Spruce Springsteen. I'll get one of those. it's been quite an exciting week here because I've got new throws for the two sofas. So, it's just... one thing after another.
So
here.
We'll look out for you in Country Living magazine. Is it? Terence
sure.
Duckholm welcomes us to his cosy abode at Christmas.
That's right. Yeah, wearing a terrible Christmas jumper and holding a glass of something. Yeah, they're always in those photo shoots. They're always the most kind of cringeworthy things, aren't they?
A couple of King Charles Spaniels at your feet there.
Wearing a tweed suit. That's the
answer. Smoking a meerschaum.
Fancy that look, actually.
Yeah, that sounds like a very Merry Christmas round at your gaffer.
Oh, superb. Apart from this excitement and also going to Stamford Bridge on Wednesday to see Chelsea win 6-1, but get knocked out of the Champions League,
that's quite a feat.
Yes, it's the way football works.
Yeah.
I better not explain or we'll be here for considerable weeks.
No.
But that was on Wednesday. On Monday, I attended a debate at a leading London media club about the good works of Lord Justice Leveson. Amongst those debating, Rich Pepiat used to be the Daily Star, and Torrin Douglas from the BBC, and the lady from Index on Censorship. Of course, that was 4 or 5 days after Leveson reported, and pretty much, I think, people have possibly had enough of Leveson now. But I have managed, and there is some relevance to this, to what we're going to talk about as our first topic, I have managed to summarise Leveson in under 50 words.
Oh, good.
So I'm just going to, I'm just going to hit you with the actual 49 words of my summary of the Leveson report. So he says, the press has sometimes behaved horrendously. The relationship between MPs and the press has been far too close. A new self-regulating body should be formed to replace the Press Complaints Commission, and it must be independent and free from the influence of business, including newspapers and their editors, and government. That's my 49-word summary. Now, the quandary, of course, that and this is what came up. We had a sort of two-hour debate on Monday about Leveson, and it seems to me that there's a nuance here, there's a nuance. nuance there, but it all seems to revolve around the differences, and the fierce debate comes to, should this independent overseeing body be backed by legislation or not?
Yeah.
And if it's yes, then it would place the actions of the press into a sort of world of legal duty. And Leveson said in the report that those newspapers who don't sign up to this backed by legislation approach should be directly regulated by Ofcom. Mm. So there's your Leveson. Now, the relevance of this Magnus Shaw is that, for our first topic this week, is that Holly Willoughby, the untroubling and smiling face of ITV's This Morning, has this week received a four-figure payment, which she's forwarded to a charity, and a front-page apology from the newspaper The Sunday Sport. And this is what happened. They published a photo of Holly Willoughby on their front page wearing a particular outfit and a dress. And next to it, they put another photo described as, and I quote literally the headline, "Holly Willoughby up the skirt photo shock." And it showed a young woman getting out of a taxi and basically her underwear was visible to the photographer. And the dress that this lady was wearing was the same, it appeared, as the one Holly Willoughby was wearing to a awards do. And so they inferred there that, you know, this was Holly Willoughby up the skirt photo shock, which is a horrible, horrible phrase. It transpired, however, that it wasn't Holly Willoughby at all. So naturally, she wanted to do something about this. It was going to go to the still just about around Press Complaints Commission, but they settled out of court, gave her a four-figure sum, and gave her a front-page apology. So, Magnus Shaw, my question to you is, should we become very riotous about this and condemn the original piece as an example of gross intrusion, or is it, as some might argue, perhaps particularly the Sunday Sport, just a bit of fun?
It's not a bit of fun. I mean, I'd have to question whether a publication like the Sunday Sport can even fall under the bracket of newspaper, to be perfectly honest. Because even if that had been a genuine photo, that isn't news, is it? That is in no shape, way or form informing, possibly to some low minds entertaining, but it's certainly not informing. And it just brings me back to what we've said before, or I've said before, is that they bring this stuff on themselves, don't they? Presumably the Sunday Sports wasn't minded to pay out this large sum to Holly Willoughby, and I'm pleased to see that she hasn't pocketed it, although she'd probably been entitled to. And so you've got to ask, you know, at the risk of indulging in a cliche, what were they thinking of? That you could see that this was going to end horribly wrong. Now, they might have taken the calculation that it was worth it for the increased sales, which is always what people say, is that, you know, the fines are acceptable because the sales, you know, you come out ahead of the game. But if the in brackets newspapers are going to do this sort of thing, they can't be surprised when you know, the outside world bears down on them very heavily, and this doesn't really help the cause of the free press, does it, this kind of thing? All I would say, really, is when there's a fuss and nonsense about this kind of feature run, is does it not imbue rather too much power on a fairly disgusting rag like the Sport? Because we get so aerated about it. It's rather like paying too much attention to a youngster who's misbehaving. Isn't it the best thing to do is to just not turn a hair, and they will eventually think, well, we're not making much of an impact here.
So sort of treat them like the troll of the newspaper world.
Yeah, just turn your back on them, really. It's, obviously, there's an issue there for Holly Willoughby and her people advised her that, you know, this is the Rubicon that's been crossed. You know, they can go this far, but no further. And in this instance, they had gone further and action needed to be taken. But for everybody to get into a moral turmoil about it, rather, I think, gives the sport far more significance than it really deserves. Because they're just prurient and infantile. It's like, it's like if you got a group of 15-year-old boys to make a newspaper, this is what would be in it. And should we really, there's so much in the world that is worth wringing one's hands about. On a moral basis, that this really shouldn't be high on our agenda because it's just stupidity, really.
You see, I wonder that whether this is enough. Okay, she got the front page apology and, as we say, the money, which she's very kindly passing on to charity. But they give a sort of explanation, but the actual apology bit says. This is the Sunday Sports apology on its front page. It was an image which had been used to create the illusion that it was of Holly. We therefore apologise unreservedly to Holly for the embarrassment we have caused to her and her family. Now, you know, even if this Leveson report gets embedded in full, which is obviously still very much in doubt, after what Mr Cameron said immediately afterwards, would it prevent this sort of what can only be described as made up journalism? They had a strong suspicion it wasn't Miss Willoughby. They used their own words, used the other photo to create the illusion that it was of Holly.
It's notable that they didn't apologise for having sort of low and ungentlemanly intentions. They've not apologised for that at all. They've apologised for
being caught.
Sorry
that they got caught.
What they're really saying is, had we got the actual Holly Willoughby's undercrackers on show, that would have all been okay. They're actually apologising for not having the shot they wanted, aren't they? That's.
Grim, isn't it?
It's grim. I think that, you know, the price of, and this is the hot potato at the moment, isn't it? But the price of freedom of expression is that some people and some organisations will use it in an idiotic way. But it's never has been an argument for not allowing that freedom, you know.
I'd like to hear, I don't think we will, because I doubt whether anybody who listens to this buys the Sunday Sport. But if anybody does, I would love to hear how anyone could say, well, actually, yes, I do go out and buy it, and I bring it home on a Sunday and sit down on the sofa having a good old read in the afternoon. I'd really be quite keen to know why someone would pick that up rather than, the Sunday Times, the Sunday Telegraph, or the Mirror, or whatever.
Well, I think it used to be said, you know, I buy the Observer for, you know, comments and editorial debate, and I buy the Sports because it's funny. That's what, you know, that has been said. But that was at a point when the Tony Livesey was actually editing the Sports. When it ran stories like the World War II bomber found on the moon, and stuff like that, you can argue whether that's funny or not, but it's certainly harmless, and it has a sort of attractive ludicrousness about it. But it's long since ceased to do that, and now it just, you know, trawls through the gutter for, you know, stories of minor celebrities, upper chest areas, and it doesn't offend me. I'm not sure. I'm not some sort of Victorian gentleman who's going to have a fit of the vapors because people are interested in young ladies' bodies. But it's not witty or funny or surreal. It's just tiresome. You know, that's really the best word I can apply to that kind of publication. It's just tiresome.
This week, Magnus Shaw, Fleetwood Mac did some press to publicise a 34-city North American tour starting April 4th.
They don't stop, do they, Fleetwood Mac?
They last toured in 2009. Stevie Nicks has spent the last 2 years touring her last album. So for her, certainly, it's been non-stop. There's a potential of at least one date in the UK, rumoured to probably be the Glastonbury Festival. They're rumoured to be chopping the bill there.
There have been rumours to that effect, yes.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Yep. But Christine McVie won't be with them, for a start, because she just doesn't want, she's basically retired, from music altogether. Stevie Nicks told us they have two new songs, but again, a big but, in what may be considered an unguarded moment with the press, Stevie Nicks said, and I'm quoting now, "Whether or not we're going to do any more songs, we don't know, because we're so completely bummed out with the state of the music industry and the fact that nobody even wants a full record. Everybody wants two songs, so we're going to give them two songs." Mm. Now, Fleetwood Mac last recorded an album of new material in 2003. So, you know, why do these artists and bands keep going? You know, is it Dr. Footlights, the adrenaline rush? Is it the money, or because they simply know nothing else? That's what they do.
Well, I think what you're looking at with the Fleetwood Mac tour is a fairly modern phenomenon, and that is the entity that is the band as corporation. There's no creative reason for Fleetwood Mac to go back on the road, or artistic reason. But Fleetwood Mac have reached that level in culture and in the entertainment business where the name Fleetwood Mac is no longer the bass player and the drummer. It is a brand name, a trading name, you know, much the same way as Burger King or Tipex or, you know, anything else, Coca-Cola, 7-Up. Fleetwood Mac, and therefore there is an impetus to do business, to trade. And if the brand name with which you have a hefty involvement is Fleetwood Mac, then the way it trades is to either put it in the studio or on a stage. And the Fleetwood Mac Corporation will be open for business. And that's why it's done. There's nothing wrong with that. And indeed, if anybody listening wants to send us review tickets, I will be delighted to hop along and watch the old Fleetwood Mac. Never seen Fleetwood Mac, and I'd like to add them to the notches on my bedpost. But
you're right. It's a corporation. It's a business model.
It is. And they are going out and plying that. Well, not, this is the thing, not their trade, which would have once been the case. The band goes on the road to ply their trade, but the management, the entertainment corporation which owns Fleetwood Mac, they're going out and plying their trade. They're being handsomely salaried for it, but really, you know, it is a trading name, and whoever has a financial interest in them has decided that they want to, squeeze the lemon one more time and reap the rewards, because it will undoubtedly sell out. So it is the rock band as corporation.
I think it'd be, I was with you all the way there till we got to the bit about will it sell out, because I think this will be interesting to see. I mean, you may very well be right, but I think this will be a very telling tour, I think, because we seem to be developing now this circuit for what you and I have come to talk about on these podcasts is heritage acts. And these days now, they, as indeed we've just had with the Rolling Stones, again, the two songs thing. They came with these gigs at the O2, two new songs, which they added to the yet another greatest hits compilation called Grrr. And again, as we talked about at the time, I proposed that those two tracks were put on there, not because they were burning to get out new material, but it was a hook to get people to buy the old stuff all over again, right, because there'll be two new songs on it. But with these heritage acts going on this circuit, what's a common factor, it seems to me, is that they're enormously priced live gigs in huge arenas. And I'm beginning to think that people attend them not... And I think you maybe have alluded to it a moment ago. I don't think people are going... because they're huge Fleetwood Mac fans that would just, you know, I've got to go and see this man. No, it's so that they can say, well, I was there. Mm. And it becomes an event like the Trooping of the Colour or a royal wedding or the Olympics. You know, that people just say, oh, well, you know, I was there when that bloke beat got the gold medal for the long jump. They couldn't remember his name 6 months later. Greg Rutherford, I can remember his name. But, you know, people who were there, or, you know, I was there when Mo Farah, won gold. Yeah. But would they go and see him next week in a run-of-the-mill race at Crystal Palace? No.
No, sure. And perhaps even more so to be able to say, I am going to. Oh, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, you never guess what? I'm going to see Fleetwood Mac. There's a bit of that as well. It's a bit of, you know,
it's kind of showing off.
Yeah, exactly.
It's bragging.
Sort of rights, waggling your social life at people, you know. And I do, you do have a point about, you know, they are, the last time Fleetwood Mac came over, I contemplated going to see them at a couple of opportunities where I could have gone. Had I bought a ticket, I mean, you know, location wise, they were close to where I was going to be. And, actually, I think tickets were £80 and I balked at that. Now, I think they're going to be much more than that this time.
Well, I can give you the details. Sorry to interrupt, but this is relevant because the European dates haven't been announced. So we don't know the ticket details, but here we're going to come back to our old friend the secondary market again. I'll try not to go on too big deal about it, but I can give you details of the ticket prices in America. You know, the tour starting in April, that they're doing in North America, and I looked up the tickets for the Hollywood Bowl, obviously Los Angeles, and they're there in May 2013, and the prices range from $61.55, and if you've ever seen the Hollywood Bowl, you're going to be a long way from the stage there. You're basically up in the bleachers. $61.55 to $319.45. Now, that equates to £38 to £199. Now, again, you may even say at that point, okay, you know, if I'm going to pay £200, the equivalent of, and I'm going right up the front with Fleetwood Mac, maybe if I'm a big fan, that's okay. But my issue is here, who are the tickets being distributed through? Yes, it's our old friend Ticketmaster. Yeah. So the suspicion will be that there'll be a small number of these tickets that I've just referred to available through online, the ticket line, I think actually opens up 17th December for those Hollywood Bowl tickets. So, sort of week or so's time. And it's 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific time that people can log in. Now, I would love to know the reality. They'll never release this information. That out of those several thousand tickets, how many of those will be released on that Monday, the 17th to 12th, to people like you and me? And how many have already been put aside to be bumped up through Ticketmaster, like you and I? You know, we found in previous weeks, £15,000 for Rolling Stones tickets, £10,000 for Beach Boys tickets. This is going to go the same way, I guarantee.
No, absolutely. That was really going to be my point. That I have no objection whatsoever to Heritage acts mounting tours, because whatever our criticisms may be, it doesn't mean it's not going to be a great show. And certainly, you know, people with that amount of experience, the Fleetwood Mac, the Rolling Stones, tend to put on a great show. I've got no issue with that at all. There is a massive issue with the suspicions of corruption in the ticket market and the price of tickets keeping genuine fans of those acts away from their concerts, and the concerts actually being filled up with people whose wallets are too fat or people who are there on corporate junkets. And that's where my objection comes. I don't object at all to bands with long track records rolling out on the road, you know, another time. No problem with that at all. And like I say, there's every chance they could put on a stupendous show. One of the best live shows I've seen in recent years was Roxy Music when they reformed for an arena tour. And they were terrific simply because they've done so many gigs. They would find it hard not to be accomplished and terrific, you know. So it's not I don't have any sort of sort of punk rock objection to old bands still doing their stuff. Quite the contrary. But the whole financial arrangement for the punter that's around those events is troubling and unfair, I think.
And how, I think we've come to realise, haven't we, by our own experiences, that the way that you can tell, here we are listeners, that your own guide, a simple, easy, cut out and keep guide, to know if you're at one of those gigs, which is where people are either there through corporate endorsement or through having paid £15,000 on the secondary market, and they're not really big fans of the band, is that if you're there to see the band, you're constantly having to stand up and dodge around people as they go up and down the stairs to the concession stands getting drinks and burgers whilst Paul McCartney is singing Live and Let Die.
Yes, we don't need to cover this ground again, but
that's how you know, isn't it?
The sheer
that's
mention of it sees my head sinking into my hands, because, yes, that is a really, really unpleasant side effect of the inappropriately allocated tickets problem, because, it's just disgraceful. I just can't express enough how much violence I wish to inflict on those people bobbing up and down. I'll have a pee, I'll have a beer, I'll have a tray of nachos. For goodness sake, the band are on. You know, I'd really think they should lock us in. They should lock us into the venue while the band are on. And I would be all in favour of stewards making people sit the F down while the concert takes place. It's awful, awful, Terence. I can't be good to tell
you. I foresee that you know, Fleetwood Mac, we've been just playing Sarah, which, as you know, is one of my favourite songs of all time. Yeah. And I could just imagine sitting thinking, oh, fantastic, here we go. But spending the entire song bobbing up and down so that people can go and replenish their fifth go at the
Absolutely.
Burger concession.
And even at the Albert Hall, you know, I think I said, you know, last year, with the squeeze and the feeling at the Albert Hall. And even there, same problem. Yeah.
And wonderfully, talking about food, that takes us to our next subject, which is that this took my breath away, this story. I don't know whether you're more up to date with the school dinners than I am, but the current MasterChef, the professionals champion, of a person called Ash Mayer, this person is going into schools. 50,000 UK school students are now going to be offered MasterChef created gourmet lunch items thanks to this Ash Mayer, apparently reigning champion of the BBC MasterChef of the Professionals, as I say. Now, this Mayer worked with chefs from a company called Cucina, who must have the franchise to produce food in school restaurants, because they're going to do this as a pilot at 41 schools that this Cucina people already are into.
I love the idea that in your mind, there's schools feed their children in restaurants.
actually in the press release, they refer to school restaurants.
Oh my good God.
This is the thing. No, I'm actually skimming the press release.
I do you an injustice then.
You do, yes.
The pretentiousness springs from the press release.
Absolutely. coming from Best Words PR, public relations company, this press release came. This Cucina have a managing director of school restaurants.
Lordy,
anyway,
lordy.
Here's the thing. Now, I want to know whether this contrasts, whether this rings any bell with the school dinners that you had when you were a young boy. Mm. Because I've got the signature dishes that these children will be having in their school restaurants, no longer a school canteen, school restaurants. This is what they're going to be offering.
Yeah.
North Korean roast shredded lamb wrap with chickpea and carrot salad with mint za'atar yogurt, £1.90. Korean barbecue pork wrap with kimchi pickled vegetables, £1.90. Mm. Next one. Wait for this. Hot smoked salmon, baby potatoes, mange tout, watercress salad with lemon and dill sour cream dressing, £1.90. Chicken and mango salad with sink soy and sesame dressing, £1.90. Couple more only. Paella salad, £1.90. Peri peri chicken, £2.10. Two more. Pineapple, coconut and lime muffins, 90p. And build your own udon noodle soup, £1.90. There's your menu in the school restaurant. Up and down the land, 50,000 school children in the new term are going to be offered these items.
I wonder how easy it would be to inveigle one's way into a school canteen at lunchtime, because that's
£1.90.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. Mm. For a start, I think I would say I'm really, really sick of organisations bringing in celebrity consultants to do things within their organisation. I've really had it up to here with it. We've had Jamie Oliver doing exactly the same. What's happened to Jamie's menu then? Has that become less de rigueur now? And, you know, he's yesterday's news. These kids are like, you know, gourmands now. And they say, oh, I'm so bored with Jamie's ham hock. That's so yesterday. Bring on the, MasterChef fella. He's really at the cutting edge of cuisine. So I thought we'd done all this anyway with Jamie Oliver in the schools. And didn't they, NHS bring in your Lloyd Grossman to do hospital lunches.
That didn't work out well.
It never works out well. And apart from everything else, they never follow through with it. You know, it gets introduced, like you say, into 40 schools or something. Absolutely bet a month's wages that this time next year, those 40 schools are just having the same as everybody else and it's not been designed by MasterChef guy. It's all... you know, it's all spit and polish. It means nothing. It helps in no way at all. And it's always very expensive. And the fat fees are, I'm sure, bandied about for this consultation, which is completely unnecessary.
I just wish I could show you this before I ask you about your school dinners. I just wish I could show you this photo. I wish everyone could see this photo because, you know, those posed photos, you could picture this photo, you know, having read you the story and told you about it, you could picture this photo because in this press release, photo, there's the managing director of Kuchina. Then there's Grant, a year 13 student at Harefield Academy. Yeah. He's got a fork in his hand. Then there's Kuchina chef Steve, this Ashmere fellow, and then year 13 student Laura Derrick. And at the front, there's this little fellow Kane, year 8. And they've all got forks. They're all staring at the camera with big gleaming smiles, and they've all got their forks aimed at the peri-peri chicken on a plate.
That there's a PR agency involved in school dinners should immediately tell you that the approach is all wrong. You know, I absolutely not somebody who would, not criticise a school for serving up poor quality food, that's deep fried and encourages obesity. Yeah, I think that is, as bad as everybody else would think it is. But the fact that you have a celebrity chef and a PR agency involved in fixing that would suggest you haven't actually found the solution.
So let me just check with you. When you were at school, did you not have North Korean roast shredded lamb wrap with chickpea and carrot salad with mint zaytar yogurt?
I think I probably had German measles that day and missed it. No, well, when I was, I wouldn't say for one minute that my school dinners were not nice because I don't recall having horrible food at school. I say that at my prep school, we had this ridiculous thing where the headmaster had decided that it was inappropriate for children to decide whether they wanted to eat something or not. So you had to have something of what had been made, because you weren't autonomous enough to make that decision for yourself. So you could either have a normal portion or a small portion. So if there was something you absolutely categorically did not like, you had to have it, but you could have the concession was you could have a small piece of it. So that was trying, and it was usually I munched my way through most main courses, shepherd's pie, spam fritters or whatever, but desserts was always a problem because school desserts when I was growing up in the 70s tended to be milk puddings. There was an obsession with milk puddings, so rice pudding or semolina or tapioca, and I despise milk puddings. Horrible, horrible things. So I do recall a good few years of having to troll my way through semolina with all the skin on top, with some really sort of anemic jam plonked onto it. You can tell there's something wrong with milk pudding, so that the fact that they have a skin on, you do not want to be eating a dessert that has something called skin on it. That's the clue, isn't it? Really? It's like, and if you had a nice teacher, you'd say, oh, do you want normal or small? He'd go, small, please, because it looks like muck, sir. Although you'd leave that last bit out. And he'd say, okay, small. Do you want skin? So there's your clue.
Oh,
there's the clue, God, sir, yeah. Why we shouldn't be eating this. It's got skin. Anyway, but other than that, my school dinners weren't too bad. When, right. when I went to my minor public school, it was much more of a canteen arrangement. You could pretty much pick what you wanted, and you know, the very nice ladies would serve it to you, and it was decent, standard canteen food. No problem with that. And I must tell you, when I went to kindergarten, make no bones about the fact I was privately educated all the way through my education. So when other kids were at little school, what's it called in the state system? I don't know. Your first school, anyway. Junior school, is that, or is the one before that?
I just went straight to prep school.
Is it junior, primary, and secondary, isn't it, in the state sector?
Okay.
Yeah. So the equivalent of junior was kindergarten. And, you went straight to prep school. I went to kindergarten first.
I wasn't allowed to go to kindergarten.
Okay. Well, at kindergarten, it was a lovely little school in Nottingham. Really lovely school to go to. And, they used to read us the Greek legends and things. It was really lovely.
Oh.
And, we'd have, dinner served up, from a table in what was sort of the games area. And it was a very simple affair because it was a small school and didn't really have catering facilities as such. And when I first went there, they would serve fairly nice main courses, soups and things. And then for dessert, there were jam roly-poly and a cornflake cake. I can remember, you know, when they put cornflakes in golden syrup.
Oh,
and
Yeah. Well, that's
so
all right.
That's nice. Yeah. Yes. So after a couple of weeks at this place, my mum said, how are you finding the food? What's lunch like? And I said, lunch is quite nice. I write the main courses. And she said, what do you have for dessert? So I usually have the cornflake cake. I like that. She goes, oh, good. Yeah, cornflake cake. So I said, but they kind of spoil it. And she said, well, how do they spoil it? You know, you can't go far wrong with cornflake cake. I said, no, the cornflake cake's all right, but they cover it in yellow gravy.
Ooh.
And my mum said, no, I'm sure they don't. I said, honestly, Mum, they do. They cover it in yellow gravy, and I don't like the yellow gravy. I like the cake, not the yellow gravy. Oh, right, says my mum, thinking, he's making this up. And she popped into school for about something on one occasion, and she said, oh, just must ask you this. Magnus says he likes the desserts, but he doesn't like the yellow gravy. You surely don't put gravy on your desserts. And they said, no, the only thing we ever cover the dessert in is custard. I'd never had custard.
I see. God. So the yellow gravy was custard.
Yeah, well, I think we talked before that I'd a fairly bohemian upbringing. And so my mum always served for desserts things like creme fraiche and fresh fruit salad and compote and, you know, that kind of thing, you know,
a bit French.
A bit sort of Habitat, you know, and
sort of Terence Conran.
Never been served custard. I mean, my mum hated custard and so never served it. And this is the first time I'd come across it. And I just thought it was yellow gravy.
Yellow gravy.
So once we'd sorted out the yellow gravy, school dinners were okay, but they were, you know, they were very straightforward, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be. You just need something warm and nutritious and not too fattening till you get home and, you and I didn't go home, did we? We were stuck there, but, on the whole, until you go home, and then you can have something especially prepared for you. But, this bringing in celebrity chefs to fix kids' menus, it's just a waste of time and money. I just can't see the point.
I'm still psychologically damaged by the events of my prep school. I think the situation is the higher the fees, the worse the food, it seemed to me. To this day, I'm still psychologically damaged because we used to have fish on a Friday. It was a Catholic school. But they used to serve up a whole fish. And when I say a whole fish, I mean a whole fish.
With the head.
From top to tail. With the head, with the tail, with the eye. And I'm not sure how they cooked it, but it was literally I suppose it had been steamed, I don't know, yeah. But you had a whole fish on your plate.
Yeah.
And the accompaniment to it was not potatoes, vegetables, it was a slice of bread and margarine.
Oh, good grief.
So you, on your plate, you had a whole silvery fish that looked like it could go flapping off at any moment. Whole one each.
Oh, no. Right.
A whole one each on a plate. Oh, God, yes. A whole fish on a plate with a slice of bread and margarine.
Oh, Lord.
And I have never eaten fish since.
No.
I still, to this day, do not eat fish. I just can't.
No.
Because it's haunted me so
much. Well, I can totally understand that. How bizarre.
Yeah. Wasn't it?
Yeah. So they must have steamed, 400 fish or something?
I guess so, yeah.
And a slice of bread.
Absolutely. We all had our own fish.
No, that's awful, isn't it? Yeah, that's not good at all. Oh, do remember there was always a kid at prep school, I won't name him on the absolute off chance that this circulates to him, but there was a guy who didn't like to eat anything. You know, you've got this classic
kid who doesn't like
anything. Well, of course, prep school was the one where you had to have something, even if it was a small portion.
Oh, yes.
So they would serve it up to him. He couldn't bring it anywhere close to his mouth. He would stare at it, and within, you know, a couple of minutes, the hot tears of shame would be coursing down his cheeks, you know. And as I live and breathe, they would make him sit there all day till home time with the food in front of him. Miss afternoon lessons until he ate it.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it was a bit like that at my school as well.
I remember walking past the dining hall and popping my head round the door, and he still sat there at 3:45 while I'm changing classes for my last class. He still sat there with cold spam and mashed potato in front of him, still crying on his own because he hadn't.
I imagine you talk about me being psychologically damaged because of the fish. That poor lad's probably still in therapy today.
Yes. Keep expecting to read in the paper one day that with his name attached, that somebody's up the clock tower of this prep school in Nottinghamshire shooting people with an assault rifle, you know. And I think, I can see that coming, you know. As
throwing whole fish at people.
And slices.
That'd be me.
And slices of bread and margarine.
And slices of bread and margarine, yes.
That would be you, won't it? You'll have a free turn and dash back to your old school and assault people with bread and margarine.
And you know, the odd thing is, 50 years later, I can still taste it. You know,
I can still taste the skin on semolina, and it gives me the dry boke straight away.
Absolutely. Last on our list before we get to the iPod, because as always, time is against us, is our television programme for review this week. And we watched on BBC4 on Tuesday at 8:30, Britain on Film. Yeah. And the last recent weeks, certainly the week before when we watched Kookyville, I think we both said it was the worst programme we'd ever seen. I'm delighted to say that doesn't ring true for this programme. I absolutely love this show. It started with Britain on Film. It started with the rank organisation Gong. And it was essentially, as they described it, a look at life in colour film, Britain in the 1960s, recording Britons at work and play. Yeah. And this particular edition was the joy of tech and the sort of press button age. And there was this clips of great big clunky buttons and dials as the voiceover from the 1960s told us we were entering the automatic era where, you know, everything would have a mechanical brain. It made me think of that famous speech by Harold Wilson at the Labour Party conference, a very famous speech that he made, 1963, where he said that Britain is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution, and there is going to be no place for restricted practices or outdated measures on either side of the industry. Good luck with that, Harold. But sort of the white heat of this revolution. And we saw power stations pumping out smoke before the Clean Air Act came in and spoilt the fun. And we looked at this power station where, amazingly, everybody looked like Richard Wattis, the sort of 1960s.
Yeah, we spoke about him, didn't we, on a recent podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, Richard Wattis.
Yeah. But Before I ask about it, I'm just going to tell you a really quick story because it rang true. You know the power station pumping out the smoke, and I just said then about the Clean Air Act that came in. I'm old enough to remember going to school with fog so thick you could barely see your hand in front of your face. But I was talking to my mother the other since Tuesday about this program, and I said, I said, do you remember when I used to have to go to school and you used to make me wear a balaclava that she'd knitted herself, and I'd burst into
which
tears.
Which, of course,
at the memory.
You could reinstate when you go and attack your old school with margarine
school
and
the fish. And the fish, yeah. I'd forgotten that bit. It just came back to me. She knitted me a balaclava. I had to wear it. Grey one. Anyway, we were talking about that when I used to have to go to school in the fog. And she said, oh, well, I've never told you about the time. When she was in London, and it was sort of her kind of, I suppose, I have to say it this way, her sort of debutante years. She would be going in a car somewhere, and she can remember many times because of this smog and smoke that was in London at the time. They used to call it, of course, Big P Super.
Yeah.
And there was one particular year in the early 1950s that she could remember where lots of people died because of it, because they were just so overcome with the smog, and there were loads of car accidents. And it was a sort of terrible time. It lasted days and days and days where people couldn't see. But she can remember being driven somewhere. And another sort of like the chauffeur's mate or whatever, genuinely having to get out and walk in front of the car, guiding the car along with my mother in the back, going to some dance or something, I don't know, some, you know, social engagement at like 3 miles an hour because it wasn't safe enough. You couldn't see. No. Further than the lights on the front of the car.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen footage of those fogs, and I don't think anybody would quite believe it, what it was like today. I don't remember them. I think the Clean Air Act had made its admirable impact by the time I was around, but I've certainly seen the footage of it, and it was more than a fog, wasn't it? It was,
It absolutely was. It was a smog that, as I say, I do recall going to school to engage with that fish. you really would be feeling your way along the walls and everything to find your way there. It really wasn't bad as that. What was your favourite bits of this rather marvellous Britain on Film on BBC Four?
Well, you know, perfectly honest, I thought this was worse than Kookyville. I just thought it was absolutely dreadful. I thought what it made me think was this is what BBC Four is all about, isn't it? And God bless it for that. You know, I just thought, a commercial channel wouldn't screen this because it had no commercial potential. What it did have was nostalgia and intrigue, which are much, you know, if not more important, equally important as entertainment. And it was absolutely fascinating, wasn't it? I think the whole deal was the Rank organization came up with this project that they were going to film everyday life in Britain for, well, as far as I can tell, as long as they could. And create some kind of archive record of everyday people leading their lives in Britain and how the country was changing around them. And I'm so glad they did it because what a spectacular archive it is. It's really, really good. And they made a really good job of it. All shot on film, of course, beautifully done. With a suitably sort of received pronunciation voiceover. It's the parodies of these kind of films are so good that now when you watch the real things, you have to keep pinching yourself and say, actually, this isn't a parody. This is really what it was like. There were just some marvellous things in it. Well, the one that caught my eye, I thought this was great, is, as you say, it was the joy of tech. This wasn't what it was called by the Rank organisation. This was the modern title given to it. And it was a compilation of clips from that Rank project of technology. But they promoted the first police responsive burglar alarm for shops.
That was a great one.
The first automated burglar alarm for shops that brought the police to your premises. Now, the first thing I couldn't help noticing was they introduced the piece by saying, it's all very well for a shop to have its night watchman. What? How many shops do you know in your locality that employ a night watchman to spend the night in the shop and keep it safe?
I know. None.
It's a dead job. None. It's a job that just doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. But, you know, at this point in what, maybe 61, 62, maybe even late 50s, every shop employed a night watchman.
And we saw him, didn't we? A fellow in a white overall.
In a white overall, sat by a paraffin heater on a wooden chair in the middle of a closed shop in the middle of the night. And, this was a job. And, you know, perhaps somebody who was less skilled than his contemporaries might find himself working as a night watchman. Whoa, what a job that must have been. Good God. I suppose you're lucky if you're in a shop, because some factories would have the night watchman in a shed outside, wouldn't they? In a hut outside.
Yes, with a brazier burning.
With his fingerless mittens.
It
wasn't
and
great.
A baklava knitted by my mum.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, a Mrs. Dacon balaclava, a patent balaclava. But anyway, this fellow at least had the advantage of being indoors in this shop. But the point was that they were suggesting that was a job that was coming to an end, because they said, Should the rapscallion force his way in to the premises, then, thanks to new technology, the police can be immediately alerted. And they mocked up a ruffian coming in through the window. and your night watchman, I don't know why he was in like a white lab coat, but he was. He hits a button. So then what do we think? Well, what I thought was going to happen is that the button would send an electronic signal down some kind of cable to the police station, where a light would come on or a bell would ring or something, and the police would go haring round there. No. This would be far too simple. Far too logical. What actually happens when he presses the button is, and I promise, for anybody who hasn't seen this, I promise this was not a spoof. This was real technology. A metal digit would extend on the end of a pole, thanks to some sort of cog system, I suppose, insert itself into a rotary dial. So we're talking about, you know, rotary telephones, pre-digital, into a rotary dial that had all the digits on, from zero to nine, all there. But this would be forced into the nine. You know what's coming, don't you? It would then go clockwise.
Click, click, once, click, 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 yeah.
Twice. It would dial. A rotary dial, 999. A big metal finger, 999. So that places the call through to the police station, just as if a human was calling 999. And at the other end, what do you think? At the other end, so you're expecting maybe a big portly desk sergeant with a handlebar moustache to say, Westminster 444. It's more automated than that. What happens at the other end of the police station is, and I swear this is true, the automated 999 call puts the needle on a vinyl record, and the turntable starts rotating, and the record plays a voice saying, "Burglary at Levinson's and Sons on Oxford Circus. Burglary at Levinson's and Sons at Oxford Circus." But with all the crackles and pops and everything that you'd get, you know, with like an old Motown 45 or whatever.
Wouldn't it be great if the record stuck?
Well, yes. Break it. And then somebody invents hip hop. It's like 30 years early. A policeman in central London invents scratching. And then this was the system. There's obvious flaws in this, isn't there? Even if that works, and my faith in that actually transpiring was slim to none, but even if that worked and the technology took off, suddenly, how many shops in the centre of a town, maybe 2,000 shops, each one has got to have a record player at the police station. So the police station is going to have a room, floor to ceiling, presumably an extension built on the back, full of 2,000 record players. When there's a break-in, the appropriate record player plays the... Because as far as I could tell, the record wasn't like a jukebox. The appropriate record was placed on one turntable. As far as I could see, every premises had to have its own turntable, right?
So what if there were two burglaries at once?
Yes, exactly. Yes. And what if the policeman on duty was at the other end of the room from the premises that had its record player down the far end of the room. And he'd just hear, you know, what's that? Well, I can hear, you know, in the distance, I'm right in at number four. It's the record player plays very quietly in the distance. Anyway, that was cutting edge technology for retail security in the early...
Transistor technology, they called it.
Yes, didn't they? Yes, yeah, absolutely. So that was just terrific. And we just rolled on from there, didn't it, with these eye-opening inventions.
Yeah, the goon-hilly boffins picking up JFK, Kennedy, on the Telstar satellite.
Yes,
But they said, maybe... Well, they'll use lasers in the future, yes, apparently so. That reminded me of the early 1980s. You know that you get this song and dance now about Robbie Williams is going to turn on the Christmas lights in Oxford Street. There's a big palaver about that. I so remember myself and my then girlfriend going up because we went up to see the Christmas lights because there's all these news stories about how for this year must have been something like, let's say, 1980, 81, the Oxford Street lights were going to be lasers.
Right.
And my God, you know, here's the future.
Yes.
And we got there, and all it was like Oxford Street. There was like, at one end, there was like a green ray of light pointing one way.
Oh, yeah.
And at the other end, there was a red ray of light pointing the other way. And occasionally they moved those beams about.
Yeah.
And that was the disastrous Christmas lights in the centre of London about 1980. And everybody was saying, well, where's the usual Father Christmas?
I liked it better before. It's just hundreds of weeping children.
Yes, what? Come to see the laser lights.
What is that?
two beams of red and green light pointing in different directions.
About as Christmassy as a synagogue,
That's right. And we saw the post office tower and its revolving restaurant, which sadly closed in 1980. I'd love to have a go at that.
It used to make people nauseous.
I should think it maybe did,
That was the problem. I think it had to be subsidised all through its existence because people would try it once and
never come.
You know, sort of have. We're talking this the unhealth conscious 70s and 80s here. So people would have a good few beers or wines or brandies and a big slap up steak dinner going round and round and then have to go and chuck it all up because of the emotion.
Yes,
so I don't think it was ever particularly profitable, albeit very famous. But
And speaking of motion and being made to feel sick, we also saw one of my favourite bits in this show was interviewing Christopher Cockerell, who developed the hovercraft.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember being on a family holiday at the Isle of Wight. I think it was about 1963 or 4, something like that. And seeing I was saying to him, I said, what's that? And he said, oh, that's the new hovercraft. And we actually saw it land on the Isle of Wight. Uh-huh. And the journey used to be so really kind of informal because it used to just rock up onto the beach wherever
could.
And then as we saw in the film clip, they actually put like an orange crate down for the passengers to step out of onto the crate and then onto the beach. And off you went about your business. But I have actually been on a hovercraft. I went, I've written before about my poor girlfriend of that time called, her name was Debbie. She was the one that was always fainting when we went to Rock Picture. We went to Boulogne from Dover. On the hovercraft in 1978. I remember it well because on the way back we found out that Keith Moon had died, so that's how I'm able to time it. But it was probably one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. It was so rickety, you know, and you bounced along. It was probably like going surfing. It was like, you know, the Beach Boys, but turbocharged, because you used to just sort of bounce along the top of the waves, but you really did bounce. And they used to have they used to call it a flight. I remember the stewards coming and doing the same sort of thing you would have on an aeroplane.
Really?
And say, say welcome to your flight, and they would stand at the front and tell you all about the sort of safety procedure.
Yeah.
And And you tell you about what you're going to do if you had to evacuate the thing. It was really fast. It was only about half an hour to get across to France.
Yeah.
But you looked out the window and you were just like bashing up and down as you went along. And then they had the gall to come and try and serve you snacks down the middle
the
of the
same
aisle.
Effect as the rotary restaurants at the BT Tower, really.
But anyway, it was absolutely tremendous, wasn't it?
It was really good, yeah.
Written on film, BBC Four, on your iPlayer, and we watched it last Tuesday.
Start of a new series as well. So, there have been two previous series, so we've just gone into colour now. So really, what we've done more importantly than that is, I guess, we've come into living memory sort of now, haven't we? Certainly for our generation. We're going to start remembering these things existing now, the trim phones and things, you know. And that's going to be really fascinating. You say, yes, they did have those when we were kids, like your lasers. And, you know, we thought we were living in a sci-fi world. But what we must always remember is that we haven't reached any kind of pinnacle of technological development with podcasts and internets and iPhones, because there will be generations after us who will have exactly the same humorous take on the technology we're using now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they'll look at the iPhone and say, look at that. People thought that was so wonderful. What a joke. That's exactly what will happen.
It will. I think we may have to ask for a warning to be put at the very front of this podcast, because it's going to be the longest one in history by a long, long margin.
Well, shall I leap into the iPod
let's
then?
Let's leap
into
the iPod. But
do it as rapidly as possible. I won't bang on.
Yeah. No, not at all. I think people at the front should just be warned. You know, you may want to listen to this in two halves.
The people who listen to it on a commute can have it the second half on the way home, can't they?
That's it. Pause. If only you could go back in time. Go back and pause, probably somewhere around when we were talking about Fleetwood Mac, and then come back.
I don't think
later.
That instruction works if you're hearing that now.
No, I don't think it does.
Anyway, crashing on. Yeah. Musos such as you, I, and the good listeners to the Parish Council tend to bow to nobody in their admiration of Bruce Springsteen, but I'm not really necessarily one of those people. And I don't dislike Bruce Springsteen at all, not by any means, but I do find some of his stuff, and perhaps his most famous stuff, a bit bombastic, you know, a bit melodramatic and a bit overfacing, if truth be known. What I do like about Bruce Springsteen is when he goes to the other end of the stick and becomes understated and strips everything back. And if you remember, in 1987, he popped out an album called Tunnel of Love, which was very much the antithesis of his Born in the USA, which had come a little before that. Everything on it was very reflective and pared back and slowed down as well. It's a really good album. And that brand, that flavour of Bruce Springsteen is the one I really, really like. So the Tunnel of Love album threw up three singles. Tunnel of Love, the title track, Brilliant Disguise, which I think led the album launched the album as a single. And then in the UK only, or in Europe only, I should say, Tougher Than the Rest was the third single. And that is my pick for the podcast iPod pretendy thing this week. the reason I've selected it is because it really reminds me of those kitchen sink dramas that we had around about the same period as the automated burglar alarm. Rita Tushing in them, Alan Bates sometimes as well. Now, obviously, Bruce is very American and they were very English, but the reason I draw a parallel between them is because they were really an attempt at showing love how it really is, not an idealized Disney-fied Hollywood version of romance and love, but love is tricky and messy and awkward and not always successful or satisfying. And on Tougher Than the Rest, Bruce draws us two characters, both of whom have, you know, maybe getting on in years, approaching middle age, and have, you know, several unsuccessful relationships behind them and are perhaps a bit jaded about the whole love thing. But, and this is the key thing, having met each other, are prepared to give it another go. And the the character who's singing the lyric, and it is a character, it's not necessarily Bruce himself, is saying, you know, if you're up and you're ready for love, he says, baby, I'm tougher than the rest. So if it gets tricky, if it gets messy, if it gets difficult, I'll still be there, because that's what real relationships are like. And I think that's really, truly, properly romantic, as opposed to, as I say, Disney-esque romance. That is real life romance. I think this is a really genuinely romantic record. And as I say, very stripped back. It's Bruce playing almost everything except the organ and percussion. Danny Federici's on the organ, Max Weinberg on percussion. And Bruce really just on a couple of guitars. And it really does sound very much like a rehearsal, but in a good way. It hasn't got masses of layers added to it. Produced by John Landau, and he's just really let Bruce and his two colleagues do the talking here. He hasn't in any way painted himself all over it as producer. And I just like the idea of somebody saying, look, and these are the actual lyrics, I'm not a handsome Dan, I'm not a sweet-talking Romeo, I'm just a guy, and I've been around a time or two, and you probably have too, and we're not the most attractive people in the world, but because of that, we're tough and we could probably make a go of this. And I think that is genuinely romantic. Its message is one of hope over experience. And I think that's quite touching. And being Bruce, he's done a marvellous job of compiling those characters into a superb, memorable and touching record. And it's my pick for this week. And it's the Bruce that I like. Tougher Than the Rest, and on the Tunnel of Love album, which was released May 1987.
Righty-o. You know how there's that sort of phrase, isn't there, that anybody who says they remember the 60s wasn't there? You could put that as well to people who say they were at the Hammersmith Odeon in London in 1975 when Bruce came, but I was there. It's the only time I've actually seen Bruce Springsteen. And it was that sort of, famous occasion when he came over and, all these posters were all over the place saying, finally, London is ready for Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band.
Oh, yeah, the future of rock and roll, it said, didn't it?
That's right.
And legend has it that Bruce spent the afternoon tearing them down, didn't he?
That is the legend. I loved the show. He came on really late, I remember. But you see, one of the things when people say, oh, you know, it must have been great to see these bands, and people say, oh, wow, fantastic. How it must have been to have seen Bruce Springsteen, first London appearance, 1975. The reality is, though, that what I do remember is that the PA system was just so terrible that you couldn't really enjoy it. It was really sort of muffled and noisy, and you could hardly hear Bruce's voice. Certainly where I was, I was sort of up on the balcony of the what's now called the Apollo, isn't it? Hammersmith Odeon back then. And that was often the case back in those days. You know, it is fantastic to be able to say, oh, I saw, you know, in this case, Bruce Springsteen, or I saw, you know, so-and-so at Hyde Park and whatever. But unfortunately, We're spoiled these days because the sound levels are so beautifully maintained now. And that's my abiding memory. I do, actually, if anyone said to me, well, what do you remember? And expected me to say, Born to Run or Thunder Road or something like that. The track I remember was the slow one, you know, that sandy 4th of July, Asbury Park, you know? But they were great, but I remember that the people I was with, we were just thinking it was a sort of era of pub rock, and we just thought they were, at the time, and I think it was a fair thought to have at the time, that they were a really, really good American sort of pub rock band.
Well, yeah, I mean,
based on what we saw and heard that day.
You obviously had no concepts as what was going to come, and all you knew, 12 months later, everybody would be saying, Bruce who? So,
absolutely,
that's why you don't necessarily have that sense of occasion, because you don't know it's an occasion. So
Exactly, yeah. So. We didn't know that it was a sort of historical occasion. Right. Exactly so. Well, there are, or were, as we know, two different versions of Fleetwood Mac. Indeed, we talked about the second version earlier on. And they were so different that the only aspect that they have in common is the name. We have that Latter-day Church of Buckingham and Nicks who came in to save the dying day in the mid-70s. And as I say, we talked about them earlier. But my track this week is from, if we may call them so, the original Fleetwood Mac. Mick Fleetwood, John McVie, Jeremy Spencer, Danny Kirwan, and the, I suppose, troubled, one would say, but talented guitarist Peter Green. And to summarise very quickly, Fleetwood Mac had achieved chart success with Albatross and Man of the World. But in an eerily similar vein to Syd Barrett with Pink Floyd, Peter Green took just about as many drugs as he could ingest, including LSD or acid. And he promptly began to undergo mental turmoil, suffering from overpowering depression and panic attacks. And he decided he wanted Fleetwood Mac to give all their money away. Well, when the rest of the band resisted, he left. But before he did so, he wrote one last song about what he saw as the evil worship of money, the Green Manalishi with the two-pronged crown. And that's my pick this week, written in 1970. It's an extraordinary, powerful, sort of haunting song based on a drug-induced dream. Listeners, don't do drugs, because anyone who has had bad experiences with drugs would identify with this song, I must say. I was still at school at this time and inevitably in a band. And in another one of those sort of strange stories that I have, our drummer, who was the same age as me in this band I was in at school, he was Peter Green's cousin. And after Peter Green had his breakdown, we went to see him a couple of times. We used to find him wandering around the streets in Twickenham, near where we lived in Staines. And he'd be wandering around with these sort of like wild, unwashed hair and dressed in raggedy sort of clothes. And the aspect I really remember is like had crazily long fingernails because he'd stopped playing guitar altogether. In fact, he'd sold his guitar. And no one would have recognised him as the man on Top of the Pops 2 years previously with a number one record. He became a grave digger. As I said, he sold his guitar. It was a 1957 Les Paul guitar. He sold it to Gary Moore for £200. And there's a story in that in itself, in that what that later got sold on for. But in this context, the Green Manalishi is even more haunting and obsessive. Gorgeous guitar work, married to sort of paranoid lyrics. Now, when the day goes to sleep and the full moon looks, the night is so black that the darkness cooks. Don't you come creeping round making me do things I don't want to do. Recorded in Hollywood in April 1970, released 15th of May 1970, reached number 10 in the UK Top 40 and staying 12 weeks on the chart. No entry at all in the Billboard Hot 100. Fleetwood Mac Magnus and the Green Manalishi with the two-pronged crown.
It's a really good pick, isn't it? And you're right that Fleetwood Mac had, well, at least two incarnations, if not more, but certainly two very definite incarnations. The blues-led outfits with Peter Green there, and then the Enormo rock bands that followed after Buckingham and Nicks joined. You can enjoy both of them, but it's quite easy to like one and not the other, because that's how different they were. They're very similar to the Floyd with Syd Barrett, and then the band that followed his similar drug-induced breakdown. So there's a really sort of spooky parallel there, really. I'm pleased to report that, unlike Syd Barrett, Peter Green finally overcame his mental health difficulties and he still has a band together now called Splinter Group, who are very popular, very successful, and he lives a very productive and healthy lifestyle. So that's the good news from that story. But because he was phenomenal, and I think had he not reacted so badly to the drugs he was taking, would have been one of the great idols from that era. He would have gone on to be, you know, as big as Keith Richards or Jimi Hendrix or whoever, because he really was very, very talented. But this
and a good-looking boy he went doolally and then started wearing these long cloaks and his hair and his beard and everything. But, if you see him, sort of black and white footage from Man of the World or Albatross, he's a regular pop
star.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, and he should have been a massive star, but, you know, fate had had other plans for him. But and Man of the World that you mentioned there is an exquisite record.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely astonishingly good record. One of the few records that can move me to tears, actually. It's, principally because of it hints at, you know, the loneliness and isolation that, that is coming for... Yeah, from his mental health problems. So that's a superb track as well.
There was a great kind of triple in a row. There was Man of the World, Oh Well, which is another incredibly difficult to play on guitar, and the Green Man Alishi with Indeed, the two-prong.
And he's sort of the guitarist, isn't he? I know a lot of very accomplished guitarists who say, I'll never be as good as Peter Green. So, yeah, that's praise indeed. So good pick. And as you say, a nice way to end the longest podcast in the history of mankind.
It really is.
But thanks.
Hour and a half.
Thanks for injecting so much into it that it went on for so long.
Sorry, listeners, and see you soon.
Yeah, so thank you very much, Sir Terence. And we better dash away then and let you do the same. But thanks very much for listening. We do appreciate your company as always. And we look forward to seeing you in a week. That's 7 days. See you then. Bye-bye.
Well, it's Saturday night. You're all dressed up in blue. I've been watching you a while. Maybe you've been watching me too. So somebody ran out, left somebody's heart in a mess. Well, if you're looking for some girls, they want a handsome dame, or some good-looking Joe. On their arms, some girls like a sweet-talking Romeo. Well, round here, baby, I learned you get what you can get. So if you're revving up for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest. Now when the day goes to sleep and the full moon looks, and the night is so black that the darkness cooks, making me do things I don't wanna do. Can't believe that you need my love so bad. Come sneaking around, trying to drive me mad. Busting in on my dreams, making me see things I don't want to see.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.
The forces of law and order are continually devising new weapons. The watchman in this Bond Street store, armed only with a truncheon, may look no match for an armed bandit. But watch that switch. It operates radio waves that set off the shop's alarm system. Modern science is making life harder for lawbreakers of every description. That dome on the left sends out sound waves that cannot be heard. But if anyone interrupted them, they'd send out a signal. This projector puts out invisible rays that do the same thing if anyone crosses them. Recognize that number? 999? When the call goes through, this is what they'll hear at the other end.
Scotland Yard. Calling Scotland Yard. Burglars have entered the premises of J. Smith and Son.